such circumstances for the person to divorce his wife in order to fulfill the positive commandments in fruitful and multiple. I could continue with other examples, but I will resist. Just to make the parallel and the analogy clear. Even if a homosexual man or woman found a spouse, a partner, who would be willing to live with them for better or for worse until death do us part, it is arguable that for a person to commit himself to a relationship which he does not feel able to commit himself to and does not fit in with his hemisphere, is not obliged to take on such a tremendous and Herculean challenge. Just like I don't believe any rabbi in his right mind would say that a man has an obligation to marry a woman. A heterosexual man has an obligation to marry a woman to whom he does not have the slightest attraction, simply because he has an obligation to procreate. But it is not only a lack of obligation. I think in many cases there is also an argument that it's unadvisable. After all, we can all have a certain degree, perhaps muster up courage to do things that are unnatural to us for a short period of time. But what about in the long term? Chochamein of Bereshai, the wise man, is able to see the future. And whilst no marriage in a way is sad, marriage that ends up on the rocks and with children being offered as sacrifice is worse still. Once again, I wish to add the point to here that I am not making any universal judgment. Every rule has its exception, and no two cases are alike. But I feel this is important because in our community, in the Orthodox community, there are rabbis or counselors, self-proclaimed leaders, of course a minority, but nevertheless there are those, and I know this for a fact, who say to the young man who comes in to speak to them, "Don't worry, get married. It'll be fine. She'll make you a nice chicken soup, and you know how to say the summer soup. The way to man's heart is through the stomach, and it'll be wonderful bliss." And similarly, women. I think that this is irresponsible. I don't think anyone does this in malice intended. I think that this is simply out of sheer ignorance. Nevertheless, since such ignorance does prevail, it is important that we make others aware, if we are already aware ourselves, of what the consequences of such knee-jerk advice may be. Number two, what is our attitude towards homosexuals? Number one, and towards practicing homosexuals, number two. And you will notice that I use homosexuals not because I believe that people should be identified by their orientation, but because in this context we are talking about intimacy, human sex, sexual relationships, and therefore in this context it is important to categorize and define who, what type of orientation we're dealing with, what type of people we're dealing with. I think that here, I think that on this second issue, I must give another introduction, another preface, only because, once again, there are people who try and divert the issue from what it is. At face value, why would the Orthodox rabbi who is committed to the Jewish tradition wish to come here and even suggest a greater degree of tolerance for homosexuals? Surely, If I were to get up here tonight and say, you know what, it's not so terrible if you desecrate the Sabbath, you would think that I was perhaps a liberal rabbi to put on a mask. Why should I say anything that could lead anyone to be more casual about something that the Torah forbids? But this is not the issue. The issue here is as follows. It is told of a great Lithuanian sage, founder of the so-called Yeshiva Brisk analytic movement, for Chaim of Brisk, for Chaim Soloveitchik, that he was once asked how come that he was so lenient with regard to fasting. And in Kippur, someone came to him and said they were finding it difficult. He was quicker than other rabbis in saying, go and break the fast. After all, punishable by Torahs. It is a severe penalty prescribed in the Torah for someone who doesn't fast for Yom Kippur. And he said, do not think that I am lenient about the mitzvah of fasting. I am being strict about the mitzvah of God in people's lives. And this is the point that propels me to indulge in the next part of my presentation tonight. Do not think for a moment that I wish to underestimate the Torah's prohibition. On the contrary, I wish to help myself and everyone else in this room to be more sensitive to the biblical commandment, Lo sa'amod al dam re'echa, do not stand idly by your brother's blood. Because the indulgences that we sometimes engage in rhetoric against homosexuals, and the insensitivity that we often exhibit, is a matter of life and death. When a person sits in a room round a dinner table and he makes a snide remark, she makes a flippant joke about people who are attracted to members of the same sex, they do not know. You do not know. Maybe you have pushed a person off the edge. Maybe there was someone sitting there who was contemplating taking an overdose. And as a result of your comment, of your remark, will cave in to the last straw. When a rabbi gives a sermon, especially in Canada, when now there is a very topical issue, the government is thinking of legislating gay marriage, and he enters a tirade or a diatribe, using, as rabbis often do, overstatement, perhaps hyperbole, in order to make an impression upon his audience. He does not know whether this type of overstatement is actually going to cause a cardiac arrest for a member in his audience, his only son or only daughter, or one of his sons or one of his daughters is a homosexual. This may not be a very palatable thought, but I feel compelled to say this, because if I won't say it, you will not hear it from other rabbis. And the Makom She'in Ish Ishtadel Yosish, where there is no one to stand up and say the truth, I feel obliged to do so. And now to the main issue. Firstly, let it be stated clearly and unequivocally that nowhere does the Torah, in its broadest possible sense, criticize a person who craves for homosexual intercourse. And I repeat and reiterate, nowhere does the Jewish tradition express the slightest condemnation for someone who craves exclusively for homosexual intercourse. To do so would not only be wrong, it would be criminal. It goes against the very foundations of the Jewish faith. When Maimonides, in his magnum opus, the Mishnah Torah and the Laws of Repentance, wishes to demonstrate why the Jewish religion is not a deterministic one, he says, because God would not be a cruel playwright, I paraphrase, who would confiscate people's free will and yet punish them for that which they are programmed to do. People do not choose their desires. A man may contemplate, may have a tremendous desire to have intercourse with someone else's wife, but he does not violate the commandment, thou shalt not covet, lo sachmod, until he starts machinating, planning, plotting, scheming to actually do something about it. If we were to be blamed for our desires, our entire religion, which insists on responsibility and accountability, would be rendered obsolete. It would have no meaning. It would be a sterile thing. Add to that the consideration of people laugh, ridicule those who have desires which are foreign to them, those who wish to engage in physical relationships that are repulsive to them, are expressing, or presumably not knowing, unknowingly, but they are being very cruel, simple and plain. And what about homosexuals who do not feel able to remain single and succumb to all too natural temptation and engage one degree or another in a homosexual relationship, a partner, live together? What is the Torah's attitude towards these people? Surely we can't speak anymore about legitimate desires. We're talking here about illegitimate actions. How are we need to relate to these people? And here the argument goes, surely it says in the Torah that it's forbidden. It says in the Torah that under certain circumstances, a death penalty is prescribed. It says in the Torah that it is an abomination. It says in the Torah so many things. After all, this is not just a cheeseburger and McDonald's. This is something really serious. How can we tolerate it in our midst? And I want to say two things here. And I'm not saying these in order to undermine the prohibition, but in order to put things in proper perspective and to enable people to adopt a total true attitude. And the two things I say in this regard are as follows. Number one, in the Torah there are two types of crimes. There are interpersonal crimes, theft, murder, dishonesty, hatred, revenge, grudge. These are bein odom lachaveiro, between man and man. There are other types of sins which are bein odom lamokrim, between man and God, such as the prohibition against, Maimonides uses these three examples: eating forbidden food, engaging in illicit sexual relationships, with the possible exception of infidelity, which is also a sin against man. Other forms of illicit sexual relationships are between two consenting adults, or sins between man and God. And wearing a forbidden mixture of wool and linen in one's garment. These are the three paradigms for sins between man and God, which are given by Maimonides in his famous Shmona Prophet, 8 chapters on ethics, chapter 6. When a member of the community engages in a sin that is bein odom lamokrim, bein odom lachaveiro, between man and man, there is room for greater revulsion, perhaps even certain sanctions. For after all, we have an obligation to protect the victim. When a husband refuses to give a get to his wife, when a woman refuses to comply with a get for her husband, there is room to consider communal sanctions. This is a severity which is not obtained when we refer to homosexual adults who do not engage in anything abusive or manipulative, as it does to heterosexual adults who do not engage in anything abusive or manipulative. Number two, whilst it is true that the Torah repeats the appellation of Toreva in connection with homosexual intercourse, sexual crimes are not the most serious. Actually, it is the desecration of Shabbos that is considered the most serious. And it is sometimes mind-boggling that communities today who recognize the difficulties and the upbringing of Western society will tolerate Shabbos profanation but will not tolerate a person who is practicing homosexual. I could go on, but I do not wish to do so because there is something far greater, and this is the second point that I wish to make. And the most important point, and if you had only come tonight to hear this point and nothing else that I have said, Dayenu, it would have been enough. And that is, when God judges a human being and his failings, he does so not only, not even primarily, by any objective standards, any punishment tariff, or other code. God judges a person for his failings. He does so primarily by taking into consideration the subjective trials and tribulations of that individual. And let us face the question honestly and ask ourselves. None of us are perfect. Many of us have committed sins, transgressions at one time or another. Even where we had permissible outlets. Have we ever eaten something which wasn't strictly kosher? When there was chopped liver in the freezer? Have we ever worked on Shabbos and we could have avoided it? Have we ever been dishonest when we could have been honest? Etc., etc., etc. Each person is only too aware of the torment of their own heart and their own failure. And yet we justify ourselves and others like ourselves. And when it comes to homosexuals, we suddenly say, hey, it says in the Bible that this is a toeva, it says capital punishment, it says this, it says that. But what about the simple question? Surely, there is more room for compassion, for understanding, for empathy, for someone who is constrained in a situation where he or she does not perceive that they have any legitimate outlet for their natural cravings. Surely, when God Himself looks down from above, we are taught that He is compassionate, whilst this doesn't give anyone the right to commit a transgression. It does give us the duty to put things in the right perspective and to assess those who don't live up to their calling in the right proportion. And I look at myself in the mirror and I say, I may commit a minor transgression. Perhaps I have a chat in the middle of the repetition of the Amida, the Shul. It's hardly a cardinal sin, but it's a sin nevertheless. Well, I have 18 hours a day in which I can talk, and I couldn't keep my mouth shut for 5 minutes. But here you have someone who commits a much more serious offense, but is a person who would have to remain celibate for life and couldn't cope with that pressure. Is there not a greater degree of allowance for that person, I ask you? Now I come to the final third of the three questions that I was asked. Please bear with me for the rather lengthy presentation, but it is important because every component part of this picture is to a degree dependent upon the other component part. Why did God create many people, heterosexual people, who have never found a spouse and have to suffer loneliness and lack of love? Why did God make so many people who fall result of emotional or physical reasons are not able to get married, and he at the same time forbade premarital sex, leaving so many people in a state of quasi-depression, anguish and torment throughout their lives? Why did God trap so many married people who crave for physical intimacy into sexless marriages. For one reason or another, which they can't escape, or there are compelling reasons not to escape. And why did God create people with a homosexual orientation and at the same time not provide a legitimate outlet for their desires? These are four questions out of 4 million. And I believe that the issue has got nothing to do with sexuality in general, or homosexuality in particular. These are questions of why God did bad things to good people. This is a question that the prophet states. This is a question that the great Tanna in the Ethics of our Father said, it is not within our ability to understand the suffering of the righteous or the tranquility of the wicked. This is the question that the Psalms, the Psalmist, the author of Ecclesiastes, Job, and philosophers throughout the Middle Ages and the modern period have grappled with and continue to grapple with. And this is a question concerning which ultimately, for the non-believer, there is no answer, and for the believer, there is no question. I admit that it is excruciatingly painful to be confronted with this question and not have an answer. And I know, and it is a fact, that this question in all its forms and shades has made many people, turned many people into agnostics. And the Talmud itself records that one of the great sages, Elisha ben Ahuya, deserted his faith when he witnessed the enormity of the question of why such terrible things often happen to innocent people, to righteous people, to great people. There are, unfortunately, many homosexuals who face this question and feel that they can no longer have a relationship with God. For that matter, there are a lot of heterosexual people who feel the same because of that question or similar questions. It's not for me to judge people. But what I can say is that as in a marriage, relationships with God is not about understanding, it's about being able to communicate. We don't understand God if we are able to stand before Him and converse and talk and express our desires and our upset, our rage, our wage, our battles that we fight, and at the same time struggle with the challenges that can never be solved completely. Then we are into a healthy relationship. We are Jews with a God. If the religious psychological burden becomes too great, then we become bereft. Whilst we can't be answerable to God, His ways are not ours, and our thoughts are not His. We must be answerable for ourselves, for our communities, for our synagogues, for our chaplains, for our youth groups, for our shiurim, for our kavusos, for our societies. My prayer is that when I come to stand before the throne of God Almighty Himself, I will be able to say, clear conscience. But I, for one, have done nothing to alienate any of his children, undeservedly so. More still, that I, for one, have tried, in this regard, to unite children with their parents, parents with their children, to make sure that people stay within the Jewish community, anchored in the faith of their ancestors, rather than desert it. To save homosexuals from the ridicule, unjustified and cruel of Jews, that they often are exposed to in the most pious of societies. To help practicing homosexuals avoid the pitfalls of promiscuity and ephemeral relationships that for one reason or another they are often attracted towards. And if there will be a resonant echo in this room, and others will join me, this will be my reward for having come from London to Toronto to share with you my thoughts today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for what I felt an extremely moving presentation, and it said a nuance really was, it said all weekend, but I agree, if this is the star of this trip, it's well worth it, and hopefully we will take his words to heart and to action. I think what we'll do now is a little bit late. We'll do approximately 15 to 20 minutes. I don't want to go later than that, just to let everybody know, a public question. Since it was only the one mic, I'll ask to ask the questions one after another to come up to the mic. Please, no statements. Keep every question under 25 seconds. All right. Ask you, please. We'll take four or five questions at a time, and then we can have the answer, and then over the refreshments, maybe, you know, privately, if some would like to speak to you. So I'll put the mic in the middle of the floor. Four, five, six people can line up. 25 seconds each, and then we'll have the answer.
First of all, thank you for a very compassionate presentation. Would you consider the concept of toiva to be something that is inherently abhorrent, or is it somehow ascribed or defined? Secondly, would we say that bia shaloka is all kinds of sexual intimacy or encounter between men, or is it only one specific kind of encounter? Third, should the concern for the social stabilization of the homosexual community affect us in any way in our thinking about how we apply the prohibition against homosexual activity? And fourth, would you differentiate between the religious prohibition against homosexuality and what should be the position of civil society, that is, the public arena, or would you say they should be the same?
In my experience, sometimes when I see people expressing an attitude towards practicing homosexuals that I think you've advocated, which is a welcoming attitude, an attitude of compassion, an attitude that we look at them as people, and we look at their practicing homosexuality as a family which is not going to define who they are as people, and it's not going to define our relationship to them. The response from the practicing homosexual couple is not infrequently, "That's not what I want. I want you to accept me and my partner and our relationship as legitimate. I want you to send us a wedding invitation that says to Charles and Samuel." And how do you respond to that response?
My question is more simple. I really appreciate the previous question. I'm just asking if you could give us some guidance on how to respond when, at, for instance, the kiddish table, there are people who are bringing up the cruel remarks that you were referring to. How do we respond to that?
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you for addressing this in an Orthodox context and in a responsible way. I do have a question about, as you said, about conversion therapy. And from what I've read, I understand it can be damaging. There was one sentence you said that I didn't hear completely, but I'd like to comment on that because I think that's an important point.
Very much. The questions that were asked were all extremely, they weren't simplistic at all. Very profound points and relevant points. And I will try, I don't think I can restrict myself to 25 seconds. Yes. But as briefly as I can. The notion of toeva, which is used in connection with homosexual relationships, can be understood in a variety of ways. The way that I think that our learned questioner presented it is something which I have seen, but I don't understand. It speaks about, there are a number of authors who suggest that there is something inherently abhorrent about homosexuality. About homosexual intercourse. Now, I agree that for those of us whose chemistry is not inclined towards homosexual intercourse, there is something inherently abhorrent in homosexual intercourse, which can't be defined or described or even rationalized. But I am not satisfied with that explanation for either, because for those people who are of homosexual orientation, they do not see it that way. They see it as something quite beautiful. And they see the heterosexual congress something as something abhorrent and repulsive. So I'd rather give a less subjective interpretation to that beautiful. There are many reasons which are given in the commentaries for the prohibition against homosexual intercourse. Some say because it diverts attention from marriage and procreation. That would make sense in certain circumstances. If you had a bisexual person, you could either get married or engage in homosexual intercourse. If you invest the emotional energy in homosexual intercourse, then it's less likely you're going to be dating a woman and get married. Especially because of your lifestyle may appeal. But that explanation is again subjective because it only applies to bisexual or people who at least have a degree of heterosexual interest. the only rationalization that I have found extremely mean, and I say this not because people don't have to agree, because you don't need to rationalize these rules anyway. But I the only thing that I have found particularly meaningful is that whilst there are many difficult marriages, I think we underestimate the amount of happiness and stability, emotional health and otherwise, that heterosexual marriages afforded to so many. I do not think that, ordinarily speaking, homosexual relationships have the same potential. And in contrast to the off-claim statement that this is because society doesn't provide a supportive mechanism for it, or whatever the reason is, I actually feel that there is something inherent to homosexual relationships. There's no fault of the homosexual or the relationship. It doesn't have the staying power of heterosexual relationships. Homosexual relationships are often doomed to be temporary dependent. And many homosexuals will say themselves that, for example, the idea of homosexual marriage is foreign to them, is alien to them. Because for them, homosexuality doesn't just mean living with a man instead of with a woman. It means living